Okay, we'll call to order the House Revenue Committee. Sorry for our late start today, everybody. We will get underway here. We've got three bills before us this morning. We'll receive the Dash 1 amendments to a testimony on the Dash 1 amendments to 3160, and then have public hearings on House Bill 3551 and 2188. Well, I have a note here that says 3160 has not had a prior public hearing.
We didn't open a public hearing.
Well, in that case, we're going to call this a public hearing on House Bill 3160. I think members had questions about this when we heard it last time, and Representative Kitts was going to bring back some amendments. We'll receive those today. And then we'll welcome you to the Revenue Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Derek Kitts, House District 30. Just wanted to come before you today and see if I could answer any questions that you might have as related to my Dash 1 amendments to 3160.
Those are before us, so do you want to walk us through those? Or, Elizabeth, are you prepared to walk us through them?
I can walk them through, Mr. Chair. With the Dash 1 amendments, what this is doing is it's kind of specifying more clearly what is the qualified investment. So it allows the acquisition and placement in service of machinery and equipment that are used in the wood products industry to qualify as eligible investment for the corporate tax credit. It also allows the payment of principal or interest on a loan which was used to acquire the machinery and equipment used in the wood products industry to qualify as eligible investment. And then finally, it allows payment on rented or leased machinery and equipment that are used by a taxpayer primarily in the wood products industry to qualify as an eligible investment. It also increases the limit on the total amount of qualified investments that the Economic Community Development Department can issue per biennium to $2 million. The amendment still doesn't really have a specific definition for wood products, so it's still very broad. And then also you have the, bringing in of rented and leased machinery and equipment. So even though you've gone up $1 million, I think you would be hitting this $2 million threshold in the 2003-05 biennium just because of the sheer number of just purchases that we've seen in the wood products industry just from the Department of Revenue data on purchases.
Okay. Thank you, members of the committee. That's encouraging to hear that we would actually hit the cap of $2 million. It would mean that people were investing. So I capped it at $2 million so that it wouldn't be an infinite number, and so that it would encourage people to beat down the doors of the capital to qualify for this tax credit. Understanding the constraints that the committee is under and the enormous amounts of pressure that you and everyone else as related to the budget are under, that's why I capped it at $2 million, and that was at the advice of your chair, who told me it would probably stand a better chance if I capped it so that you could see better how it would fit into a bigger puzzle as related to tax credit bills. So if there are any other questions, I'm more than happy to answer them.
Okay. Other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Your Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, sir. I'm looking at the original staff measure summary, and it indicates that this applies to tax years on or after January 1, 2002. Is that still true with the Dash 1?
I believe so. That did not change.
Okay. Follow-up?
Yes.
I guess I'm a little confused as to why we would be adopting a tax credit to encourage people to do things they've already done.
Well, I think it's a continuation, an ongoing thing of this that's related to purchases made in that may be leased. So what we're not disqualifying them from future investment. It was the intent. So if people are gearing up or have geared up to do such things, we wouldn't be disqualifying those investments.
Representative Barnhart, did you say 2002 or 2003?
Well, the summary says 2002.
Oh, okay, the bill, then that would be an error.
There's an error in the bill.
Well, I don't know. Where are you looking?
Mine
say
3.
Mine says 3. That's three.
It is 2003 anyway in the bill, whatever you're
looking at. That'll teach me to read the summary, huh?
I'm reading the summary, too.
Thank you. I guess I think that answers my question.
And so tax years beginning January 1 would be the current.
Of 03.
Tax year, yeah.
Yeah, and
right.
Retro to this year.
Right.
Oh, that's page 2, line 34.
Right.
No, I see.
Oh, Representative Berger.
I see it. It's down in the background. It says applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2002.
Well, that's what I was looking at.
Yeah. In the staff summary, under background, last sentence.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I really meant it for be a simple bill.
Yeah.
Not the dash one, the original.
Okay. Oh. Mm. Okay. Well, yeah, I had a Representative Kitts, but now we're all confused. Okay. But we're settled anyway. It's 2003, whatever else.
And then a question on a different topic, if I may. Representative, has the committee received information that points out the need for this tax credit? It may just be that I don't have it, or that I missed it somehow. But
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, the reason for this, it's kind of a preemptive measure with the president's possibly passing down the Healthy Forest Initiative, and so on and so forth. That we seem to be wanting to diversify our economy away from such a high tech economy. I was just simply trying to come up with something that would make it easier for folks to start up mills that have been shut down. I believe there are over 100 mills in our state that have been shut down as a result of a diversification away from our natural resources. And I just wanted to help people and encourage people to get those mills running and help some of the most depressed areas in our state. And for the record, I have no mills in my district.
Mr. North Plains, yes,
Representative Kitts, does this in any way address the need for mills to retool to handle smaller diameter logs?
Well, and I think that's what it's geared for, is for the investment in the modernization and the upgrading of the mills, and that would be included. The conversations that I've had to do one of these overhauls to one of these mills is between $8 and $15 million. So it's not, and I realize that we can't subsidize, nor would I want to subsidize, but I'd much like to encourage folks that, yes, you know, we feel your pain out here and want to do something to encourage you to get some of the most depressed areas back to work.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I do have lots of closed-down mills in my district.
Let's get them open.
Several former mills in my district, too. Representative Verger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to say that I think the bill is really an economic stimulus bill because the trees have been growing since the mills have been closed. So now there are people who are very interested in looking at the very near future and perhaps being able to reopen mills and to be able to process the timber. I think it would be a real shame, however, if we are unable to handle that process in Oregon, and that actually the trees get cut and go to another state to be processed rather than being able to be processed in Oregon. And I do have some areas, mills that were closed in my district, but I think it is a good economic stimulus bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, that is the intent of the bill. And I have been told numbers that if we were just simply able to process the burnt timber of the Biscuit Fire, that it would be more lumber than our existing mills could handle. And that's not anything dealing with the President's Healthy Forest Initiative. That's not dealing with anything other than the burnt timber of the Biscuit Fire. And for me, it would be a shame having all the infrastructure up, and I would rather get ahead of the curve instead of being behind the curve, where we're sending logs, we're sending the product to Idaho or Northern California or the state of Washington to harvest, when we have, you know, we lead the country in unemployment and so on and so forth. So it was kind of a preemptive strike to try and get these things up and running in anticipation of the President's Healthy Forest Initiative. My understanding of President Clinton's forest plan, that we're operating at about 15 to 20% of the capacity that he authorized in his administration. And so I just, as we're gearing up and going to attack this problem in a smart fashion, I want to be ready to do it and keep the jobs here.
Follow up, please.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I agree with that. Not only if you're going to leave it all lying on the ground after the fire, and you don't hire people and create jobs to clean it up, it's going to go into other systems, water for one.
Sure.
And so I think there are a lot of reasons to talk about cleaning up the salvage.
Thank you.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I agree with everything that's been said so far about the economic development. There is a link, however, that I think is missing in the logic about this bill. And I'm not certain I can get at it, but let me see if I can try at least. What I don't understand is the link between the economic development that we're talking about and the action of the bill itself. As far as I know, we haven't received any data that explains why it is that this particular tax credit is going to have all these wonderful effects, or isn't simply a reduction in taxes for people who are going to take actions anyway in order to take advantage of these changes. Now, what information do we have that demonstrate that this tax credit is really necessary in order to accomplish the things that Representative Kitts and Representative Verger have been talking about?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I think you make up a great point, and I was very excited to hear that the committee administrator here believes that the cap will be maxed out because of people seeking to invest in it for this reason. There's nothing to say that this is going to have that desired effect. It's an attempt, you know, at addressing a problem out there, and with being such a high dollar amount, $8 to $15 million, depending on when the mill was shut down, just encouraging people, saying, hey, you know, get involved. This is a good industry to invest in, and if you invest in it, we're willing to help you out. There's nothing that says that they won't do it anyway. But on the flip side of that, you know, I've stated publicly that I wouldn't support any tax credit this session that didn't have good family wage jobs tied to it. And I believe that a bill like this, I mean, I know what the mill industry makes. I've had family that works in the mill industry for almost 40 years. And it's dependent upon the mill industry, and I will tell you that it's a dying entity out there, but they are good family wage jobs, and if we can do anything to bring them back, any incentive, be it $100,000 of an $8 million investment, I'm willing to take that chance to help those people.
Mr. Chair.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hass.
Thank you. Where in the legislation, then, is this tied to good family jobs that you spoke of? I mean, is there a provision? I don't see one that says, you know, the beneficiaries of this tax credit must also employ this number of people at this
point. No, there's not. I think if you check around what mill jobs pay, Mr. Chair, Representative Hass, that mill jobs pay above the $11.05 an hour that the AFL-CIO defines as a family wage job. I would also say that as far as economic stimulus, if we build the mills in Oregon, it will be Oregon jobs, and the timber and the fallen timber and the burnt timber won't be sent elsewhere to be processed. So I think it is an economic stimulus. Does that answer your question?
Well, it does, in so much as that there's, even though you said that you would like this type, you wouldn't support a tax credit bill that's not tied to good family wage jobs. This legislation, in fact, isn't tied to any kind of language that suggests that there's be family wage jobs into this mix.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hass, I respectfully disagree. This is geared at an industry that promotes family wage jobs, and that's why I support it.
Okay, anything else? I just had a couple. One, committee, for everyone's information, and to set the record straight, this confusion about the January 2 date on the staff measure summary on the original bill, not the dash one, but the original. That January 2 date.
January 2002.
January 1 of 2002, thank you. It occurs in a paragraph that explains House Bill 2033 from last session. So that January 1 of 2002 date describes House Bill 2033 from the 2001 session. So that's why that's there. And the other question I had, we talked about a definition of wood products industry last time. The Dash Ones don't include a definition. Are you comfortable that wood products industry is well enough defined for the purpose of this bill to get at the mills that you're talking about? I think you were distinguishing it from actual harvest, and I don't know whether we talked about pulp and paper products, whether those would be you would intend those to fall in the definition of wood products industry.
Mr. Chair, I am comfortable. If the committee would like to tighten it up, I'm open to amendments, but I'm comfortable with the language as used.
Okay. Deborah, would the Department of Revenue want a tighter definition of wood products industry? Don't you love being called on?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair.
Oh, that's a good answer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. Mr. Chair, Economic and Community Development is issuing a certificate for the credit. So to the extent that they are determining what that means, however, it would be helpful. I think of wood products industry, including mills, but also what comes to mind is a furniture manufacturer that takes the wood product and creates furniture. If I were a wood product, a manufacturer of furniture, I would argue that that should qualify. I think maybe any industry that takes a wood product and does something to that and creates something else would have reason to argue that they should qualify for the credit, and I don't know whether that's the intent of Representative Kitts or not.
You know, it's something else that occurs to me since you're about the Economic and Community Development Department tie-in, and going back to your question, Representative Hess, they do administer certification for enterprise zones and other programs that also include certification as to level of wages and things like that being paid. So you could even tie that in explicitly as a qualifier for this tax credit if you wanted to get that specific about the level of wages being paid by an applicant for the tax credit.
I'm more than happy if that would, Mr. Chair, if that would represent or if that would address Representative Hass's concern, because it's certainly my intent to bring those living wage jobs. And I wouldn't say bring them to Oregon. I would say bring them back.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Does anybody else want to be heard on this today? I think I want to have a little more conversation with committee. Yeah, come on in, Roger Martin.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin. I represent Timber Products, a privately owned firm headquartered in Springfield, Oregon, but with major plants in the Medford area. And I'm not an expert on this bill, but I would like very much to encourage you to consider it seriously, in spite of the fact that all of local government is going to come up here and talk about how disastrous this is going to be on the tax roll.
Oh, no, they won't care. This is income tax credit, so local government doesn't care about this.
Well, or somebody else in the state is going to testify against it. My concern is, the forest products industry is in desperate straits in this state. Just for a moment, let me describe Timber Products. It's a firm with 5 plywood and chipboard mills in the Medford area. They make not only regular plywood, they make finished plywood, and they even go on beyond that to do further milling to make it specifically for cabinet makers and so forth. They cut it to size. They even lay up some of the material. They use softwood interiors and finish it with hardwood veneer from all over the world. During this entire downturn in the economy, they haven't laid off one person during this. Mills all over Southern Oregon are closing. You read about the mills that closed in Roseburg the other day. There are more mills closing this week. And I talked yesterday to Chuck Smith, who's the Senior Vice President of Operations in the whole Medford area. He says the economy in the forest products industry just gets worse by the day. Anything that can be done to encourage them, and they're interested in this bill because they spent a lot of money on machinery. Do they need it to operate? Do they need it to stay alive? Probably not. Would it encourage them to expand? It certainly would. And I think we ought to do a few things to encourage the forest products industry. I get really irritated sitting here when people come to you and suggest that the Tillamook Forest and Representative Hobson's district, that I happen to have personally had a little bit of planting part in when I was a school kid, went down and stuck some Douglas fir in the ground. I hope those lived. It irritates me when people say, let's lock it all up now just for recreation. Back then, I think if you'd taken a vote of all the school kids helping, it was to put the forest back in production again. And if there's anything that can be done to encourage a change in attitude in this state, I would love to encourage you to do it. And this is a bill that I would like you to consider. If you are interested in any further testimony, Chuck Smith, who I mentioned, is going to be here to testify on another issue in the Ways and Means Committee on Thursday. And I would love to have him add his expertise because he could tell you specifically how this would help the industry.
All right,
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Mr. Martin? All right, thank you. Does anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 3160 before we close the hearing on that? And once, twice. Close public hearing on House Bill 3160. Let's open then a public hearing on House Bill 2188. Thank you, Elizabeth. We got our forestry guys back.
Yeah. Good morning, Mr. Chair. Right. Richard Gates with the Legislative Revenue Office, members of the committee. This is a bill designed to stimulate the timber industry.
close the public hearing.
The 99 legislature began a process of phasing out the previous way that timber was taxed, where
we know that
and the 2001 legislature continued that process, and without further action essentially we come to a system where all forest land is on at 100% of its of the lesser of its specially assessed value by the Department of Revenue or its maximum assessed value under Measure 50, and there are no severance taxes. So that leaves us with a lot of sections in ORS that are essentially obsolete or which have obsolete language in them. Also, as a part of that process, that 2001 change, you eliminated the Western Oregon Small Tract Option Tax. So what this bill does is to go through and delete all of the obsolete sections, amend those sections which have now obsolete references, to the various programs. It does some consolidation and reorganization where gathering together the provisions particularly that apply to Eastern Oregon. And then amends, once it's changed all the sections numbers and so on, and amends the sections that reference those to correct the section references. And essentially it's just a housekeeping bill to clean up the timber statutes.
Dick, and maybe we can ask Norm Miller. Well, in fact, Norm Miller and Joe, is it Misek?
Misek.
And Wally Rutledge, why don't you all three come on up? Somebody explain to the committee how this relates to House Bill 2197. That was the
big
small tract bill that we did earlier. We could just have some explanation of the tie-in between that and this, and also maybe just for the committee's information, where House Bill 2197 is in the Senate process right now, for those who are watching that. Who wants to go first? Norman Miller.
I can take this on. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Norm Miller. I'm the Timber Tax Operations Supervisor for the Department of Revenue.
Keep grabbing microphones like that, and someone's going to sign you up to run for the legislature.
See that, or I'm going to start singing. Actually, what I've handed out was my testimony that it actually has just been given by Dr. Yates, talking about where this bill comes from the 99 and 2001 legislatures. What the current law says is with regard to the privilege tax is it sets the privilege tax rate at 0%. But it does not get, the current law does not get rid of the implementation that requires the Department of Revenue to send out forms. It requires taxpayers to return those forms. So this particular bill is the implementation of that to really get rid of those kinds of requirements. It's been known really since through this legislative session, that House Bill 2197, which this committee passed about a month and a half ago, which implements or begins a new tax program, which is a small owner tax option. That bill passed along and is currently in the Senate Revenue Committee, has been there for about a month, well, almost a month and a half. I guess this committee dealt with it about 2 months ago, I think. It's been sitting there. There are a couple of different issues that have come up within that committee. One issue is in regard to how forest land in eastern Oregon is valued, especially in regard to in western Oregon we have productivity classes that establish the value of the land in western Oregon. Excuse me. In eastern Oregon, there's one single value. There are some members of the small woodland community that would like to have their eastern Oregon lands classed by productivity class and valued as such. So that's one of the issues that's out there right now. The other issue is that House Bill 2197 does have a revenue impact, and I think there was some. My understanding is there was concern about that revenue impact. Or about any revenue impact in the bill. So the bill is currently within that committee waiting to be heard some more.
Okay. We'll come back to questions. Wally, do you want
to? Yes, Chair Shedley and members of the committee, my name is Wallace Rutledge. I'm Director of Forestry Assistance with the Department of Forestry. I have with me Joe Misak, who actually was going to deliver the testimony. I'll just give you a brief summary here. Our only concern is the conflict with 2197 with this bill. And Norm explained to you where that bill is and what's happening with it. We're hopeful that that bill will get passed on. The issues will get solved. I know there's some things going on now behind the scenes to try and resolve some of those issues over there. And we're hopeful that's going to happen. We'd be happy to work with the Department of Revenue to amend this bill to make it compatible. The incompatibility is that House Bill 2197 actually extends two of these tax programs for one more year until the new tax program goes into effect. That's in House Bill 2197. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Let's hear from Mr. Misak, and then we can come back to the panel.
Chair Shadley and members of the committee, given what Dick has already provided and Wally and Norms, I have nothing further to add.
Okay. Questions then for these three. Question I would have, is a timing issue. Are we ready to move on this? Do we need to know what's going on with 2197 if we need to make some conforming amendments here? That's the question I would have with this.
Mr. Chair, Norm Miller, the original intention was for 2197 to go through the process so we know exactly what it says so we could amend 2188 to conform to that, have that happen on the House side, so everything went through pretty cleanly. At this point in time, considering the timing that you know, you're very aware of the legislative session itself, 2188, I think, regardless, needs to pass. For these reasons. If House Bill 2197 does not pass out of Senate Revenue Committee, then we need this particular bill, 2188, to implement what the current language of the law is. But I think it's really preferable, at least in my mind, with all the work that's gone into House Bill 2197, that bill does pass through the legislature, and if so, 2188 does need to be amended to conform to 2197. Where exactly it happens, I think it's preferable on the House side, but considering the timing, I think we might use the process on the Senate side.
Okay. Any other questions? For these three, what I'd like to do then is close public hearing and not work this today, but maybe let me take a temperature of the water down in the Senate and see if I can figure out what's going on with 2197, and then we can either amend this or just move it and get it in the process and let the amendments catch up with it down in the Senate. But having just heard this for the first time, I think my inclination is to see what's going on with 2197 first, and then we'll take action based on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. Close public. Does anybody else want to be heard on House Bill 2188? All right. We'll close public hearing on that. We need Representative Krupp for 3551. I think he said he was next door. We can get him. We'll stand at ease for just a minute. Committee, that means the microphones are still on.
Okay, there's two guys walking away.
Yeah. Who's staffing 3551?
No.
Mazin? Okay. Okay, okay.
The ceremony was awful, but the reception was great.
Oh, this one. That's very yeah. Short.
Thank you.
Sounds like a mad police.
Well, what did you say?
No. He said my business got married. Yeah. The ceremony was awful, but the reception was great.
Well, that is horrible.
No. I think it sounds like a mad police playing journalism.
What's that?
Vicky Berger's joke.
What was it?
I hear your name.
Go ahead, say it.
She said, it's your joke, Mr. Chair. Two satellite dishes got married. The ceremony was awful. The reception was great.
That is your comfort over.
I'm still figuring out how to use...
Did you love that?
The fact, I saw that. Having just discovered, I don't know why it took me so long to discover that we have a representative close and a representative far in the legislature. How on earth do you use that?
Close and far.
I have no doubt that you will find a way. And you'll see me roll my eyes.
I know. Okay. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 3551. Representative Krupp, we welcome you to the House Revenue Committee. And Mazin, why don't you give us the background?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3551 expands the property tax exemption for the ethanol production facilities, and it also increases the number of years for the exemptions that this would be claimed. Just to bring it into perspective, the ethanol production facilities do have in law at this time a 50% property tax exemption for 5 years. And this bill will extend it to 10 years and increase it to 100%. And just to go quickly on the ethanol, as you probably are familiar with, is a chemical alcohol. It's extracted from corn and used in oxygenating fuel. This is to be blended with gasoline to satisfy the federal requirement of oxygenated fuel that reduces ozone emissions and reduces pollution in the air. This time, the way we were looking at this, there's a proposed one plant to be built in Columbia County. The size of the plant probably will be able to satisfy the market, Oregon market, and perhaps most of Washington's. And because of the economies of scale, we don't see plausibility of building another plant anytime soon. However, the revenue impact associated with the bill would bring into action or invoke the other clauses or other sections of the statutes, namely ORS 306353, which I included in your packet as a reference, and this is known as to be the property tax expenditure funding segments. It says that if the legislator increases exemptions, it has to fund them through the account, although the account doesn't have much money in it at this time. But eventually, if that's the choice of the legislator to go with, it might need it to be funded accordingly. The revenue impact, as it's seen from this 100% exemption up from 50%, would affect about 9 taxing districts in Columbia County at this time.
it's estimated to be around $350,000 a year. And after that first 5 years that originally in the law today, the extension to the next 5 years will probably be the whole thing of around $820,000 or so. In addition, we have received also an amendment of a Dash 1 amendment. The Dash 1 amendment talks about biofuel and the production of biofuel. I haven't been able to examine whether that's a new plant or a new facility and how much that would be.
I'll bet we'll find out. All right, Representative Krupp, Mr. Endicott, I take it. Welcome.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm State Representative Jeff Krupp, House District 17. With me today is Thomas Endicott. The issues before you are really have come out of a task force that Speaker Simmons graciously allowed me to chair, and got a bit of a late start in the last interim because of numerous special sessions. In fact, I think we finished up just before Christmas, to be quite honest with you. And we talked a lot about the alternative fuels industry and how it may be possible to move that that industry forward here in Oregon. Why would we want to do that? Well, there's some really great reasons. First of all, producing cleaner burning fuels is great for the environment. Producing a different type of crop mix is good for the agricultural community. And by crop mix, I mean growing crops specifically designed for alternative fuels. And thirdly, I think it's all, I think all of us would agree that it is a good idea that we try to reduce our dependency on foreign oil imports. And I think that the concept of Oregon becoming a major production area for alternative fuels holds a lot of promise for the future, not just for Oregon, not just for Washington State, but for California. Thomas will chair with or will share with you some ideas, and has about a 20-minute presentation. Well, what is alternative fuels? What's ethanol? What is biodiesel? And why is it a relevant idea for us to consider now? Some years ago, about 10 years ago or so, Minnesota went forward with a major policy initiative of this type. And over the last 10 years, they've built about 14 ethanol production facilities. For, according to the University of Minnesota study, for every dollar of subsidy that the state put forward, they received $12 in economic activity. Today, ethanol is 20 cents a gallon cheaper in Minnesota than unleaded gasoline. And I got that from the mouth of a Minnesota state senator a couple of months ago when I saw him. And they are a net exporter of ethanol. So they have created quite an awesome industry. Why would we want to do this? Well, if we can provide fuels for blending, as your committee staff has articulated, for the California market, not only for a replacement for MTBE, which is being phased out of California, if we could provide ethanol for that purpose, if we could provide biodiesel for that purpose, because in 2007, California mandates super low sulfur diesel. And what that means is the sulfur content in diesel is what gives it its lubricity. So that's the oily feeling in diesel. And that's what helps a high-compression diesel engine operate and function appropriately. There's a phenomenal marketplace in California for these products. Now, why wouldn't they grow them in California? Because these crops are not high enough value to replace the high-value crops that they grow currently in the California marketplace. But because of Oregon's close proximity to California, we are a natural area, growing region, that could potentially export these two products, and others, actually, that bio-oils, hydraulic fluids, those types of things, all made out of organic vegetable-type oils. Mr. Chair and members, keep in mind, when diesel engines were first developed in the late 1800s, they actually were developed to run on peanut oil, not petroleum-based oil. And it's a fascinating circle, I guess, of life cycle of this whole concept that we would go back to in this age of high technology, going back to a low technology concept, growing fuels for the purposes of meeting our energy needs. So that's what House Bill 3551 expands the ethanol statute to include the biofuels definition, which is biooils and biodiesel. We have a companion bill, House Bill 3278, which hopefully will be in front of you shortly, which has deals with the pollution control tax credit and also expanding it to allow the biofuels industry to qualify for certain portions of that. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm not going to say much more for the moment, because what I'd really like to do is lay the foundation with Thomas's presentation. He can tell you a little bit about who he is, why he's involved with this. He has extensive knowledge. We have two other members of our work group here. We have a gentleman who is building the 100 million gallon facility in the Clatskanie area, is here today to share with you why they're doing that, why they're going forward with that process here. And we also have, I think, is Michael Graney? And we also have another member of our work group, our task force, Michael Graney from the Department of Energy, and Brian Doherty representing our friends in the petroleum industry. So we would like to move forward this time, Mr. Chair. And Phil Thomas.
Thank you.
Mr. Endicott, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I appreciate the opportunity to come and present. I have 10 copies of my presentation here. Which I can.
Was that different?
Why don't you hand them?
Was it this one?
Yes.
Is that different?
And I also might submit this if you're interested in looking. This is a sample of biodiesel.
Looks like Representative Cruz's jam jar.
Hopefully I can dispel a lot of the jokes and humor around biofuels, because I think a lot of people, they think about biodiesel, they think about ethanol, they think about drinking alcohol, they think about waste grease from fryers, French fries. It's very real, and I hope that through my presentation I'll convince you that this is a very real future fuel that's available and it's viable today. Quickly, Representative Krupp asked me to come and give you sort of some context and some vision for biofuels in general, and I am here to support both House Bill 3551 and House Bill 3278, so the material in my presentation should speak to both of those bills. And quickly, to get started, sort of a global context, biofuels have been gaining a lot of ground in the last 6 months especially, clearly because we have some situations in the world revolving around petroleum, more issues around emissions and the effects of consuming petroleum. Our culture is never going to be free of petroleum in the next 40 years, but we can make some steps in some different directions. This is an article published in U.S. News & World Report, February 17, 2003, Kicking the Oil Habit. It was an article that covered four alternative fuels: biodiesel, ethanol, compressed natural gas, and hydrogen. Of those four fuels, three of them are available right now. Hydrogen is not a viable alternative today. Biodiesel, ethanol, natural gas. Two of those are viable with very little change, and in fact, no change to the infrastructure, and that would be biodiesel and ethanol, and those are biofuels. Interesting article. I'll also just say that there's a lot of interest from nonprofit groups like the Harvesting Clean Energy Coalition from Olympia, Washington, report on biodiesel. They are very supportive of biodiesel and ethanol. Farm-based fuels, I'll get into that a little later. Representative Krupp mentioned the 100 million gallon plant that's to be ethanol plants to be built in Clatskanie. This is an email that I received yesterday about two ethanol plants planned for California, $90 million to produce two ethanol plants. This is clearly to replace MTBE in California. This is a huge market, and I'll cover that in just a minute. And lastly, before I dive into my presentation, I wanted to share with you a quote from Representative Chuck Grassley from Iowa. He's the Finance Committee Chair in the Senate, and he's very supportive of these bills, and I'll talk about that toward the end of my presentation. This is a quote from him: renewable fuels improve air quality, strengthen national security, reduce the trade deficit, decrease dependence on Saddam Hussein for oil, and expand markets for agricultural products. And he's referring to an amendment I'll talk about at the end of my presentation here. This amendment is helping the federal government lead by example as we use renewable fuels where practical. And there are places where that's possible today. So quickly, my name is Thomas Endicott. I'm managing member of a company called Sequential Biofuels. We're a limited liability company out of Eugene, Oregon. We have only been in existence for about 8 months, and we are marketing and distribution of biofuels, mainly biodiesel currently, but we're also looking into the ethanol market. And I have an interest in these bills, clearly, for building the market for these two products in the region, but I'm also largely interested in cutting the cost of these products to help build the volume in the markets. Currently, all biodiesel and ethanol is produced in the Midwest. It benefits soybean farmers. It benefits corn farmers. 20 cents of freight on every gallon of biodiesel or ethanol that comes into Oregon for the distance that's traveled. So something to think about. Properties of biofuels, again, talking about biodiesel and ethanol. These are well-tested and proven. Ethanol has been blended with gasoline for the last 25 years. The market has grown significantly. There are some incentives for why that's been true and why that's happened. Biodiesel has been tested in over 40 million miles of road testing. It's generally blended with diesel fuel to get the highest environmental benefit for the least incremental cost. I'll talk about that in a minute. B20, 20% biodiesel, 80% petroleum diesel. There's no modification to existing equipment. Biodiesel in its pure form or in a blended form burns in any diesel application with no modification. That includes transportation engines, generators, heating oil applications, boilers, any diesel application, no modification. As Representative Krupp mentioned, Rudolf Diesel invented the diesel engine in 1895, patented it in 1895. The original fuel was peanut oil. Likewise, ethanol, no modification. Ethanol is blended commonly 10% in gasoline all over the country. In Portland and Medford, it's especially done in the wintertime when they have some air inversions and some air quality problems in those urban areas. Biofuels support American agriculture. Every gallon, every barrel of petroleum that we buy that is not domestic is imported. That money is exported outside the country. Every gallon of ethanol or biodiesel that we purchase that's produced here, we don't import biodiesel or ethanol from other countries. That benefits American farmers. Currently, it benefits Midwest farmers. It could benefit Northwest farmers. Increases American energy independence. This is something that we're all interested in. The more we can control our own energy sources, the better off we'll be. I don't think I have to explain that too extensively. Improves air quality. This is probably where biofuels got their foothold. Ethanol and biodiesel are both oxygenated fuels. They reduce emissions. They don't include the polyaromatic hydrocarbons that gasoline and diesel fuel, the petroleum-based products, have. And those are largely the carcinogenic pieces of those fuels. So reducing air quality or improving air quality through their emissions is a significant improvement. But I think, in looking at all this, economic development is really what we're looking at. This is really the opportunity here. Non-toxic and biodegradable. These products are, you spill them on the ground, they are not hazardous. When blended with petroleum, they are, in their pure form, they are not. They biodegrade very quickly. It's not a problem. Sources and byproducts of biofuels. This will give you a little idea. For biodiesel, waste vegetable oil is a very real source, and this would relate, for example, to the pollution control tax credit. There are markets for waste vegetable oil. It's collected. There are biodiesel plants in the U.S., a couple million gallon per year plants that use strictly vegetable oil. I didn't list it in this presentation, but animal tallow is also an opportunity. There are several biodiesel plants growing up around animal slaughterhouse facilities around the country. With mad cow disease and those types of issues, there's a real question as to what to do with that material. Ethanol, food processing waste. J.R. Simplot has one of the only ethanol production facilities in the Northwest in Boise, and it is potato waste from their French fry operations. Oil seed meal, and glycerin. This is biodiesel from a raw standpoint. Soybean oil, soybeans, you take them, you crush them, you get oil and meal. The meal is a food for livestock. The oil goes into the biodiesel production. Glycerin is a byproduct which can be used in all different types of products. Highly refined glycerin is everywhere, from nutraceutical gel cap pills to lotions, soaps, all different types of products. For ethanol, grain and DDG is is dried distiller's grain. That's what's left over after you cook the grain. DDG is an excellent source of feed for livestock. And grain could be wheat, could be corn. Basically, ethanol can be made from any type of grain. There's some economies there that are of concern. both DDG and oilseed meal for livestock, I believe, are imported into the Northwest because there's a shortage here. We don't produce that here in the Northwest. And this is further out. The National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado has done extensive research on biodiesel and ethanol, and as well as other biomass products. And they look to the future 10 years down the road. Algae, actually, saltwater algae could be a very good source of oil for biodiesel production. This would be, we would be in a very ideal location, being close to the coast. We have saltwater, we have heat, we have sunlight on the coast. Cellulosic ethanol production is from wood waste or wheat straw or grass straw. Again, everyone in the industry believes this is maybe 10 years away. It has to do with developing the enzymes that would break the cellulose down to hemicellulose, which can then be converted to ethanol. So these are some things on as a vision for the future that Oregon might be able to be involved there. Biodiesel specifically, I want to talk about how biodiesel relates in Europe and in the U.S. Percentage of vehicles that are diesel-powered in Europe, greater than 50% in Europe, less than 1% in the U.S. Why is this? The diesel engine is extremely efficient. If you take a diesel vehicle and a gas-powered vehicle, that diesel vehicle will get 30 to 60 more miles per gallon than the gasoline vehicle. Fuel is very expensive in Europe. They understand that they need to be more efficient. They're more efficient. Diesel is catching on again in the U.S. Some of the major auto manufacturers like Mercedes and actually Dodge, which is owned by Daimler Chrysler, are bringing more diesel vehicles into the market in the next few years. So also I'll mention that the California Air Resources Board did an about-face on diesel about 6 months ago. There's concern about diesel emissions. In Europe, they have gotten their emissions to a point where they're actually better on a per-mile basis than gasoline engines, and I can talk a little more about that. Sulfur content of diesel fuel, this is where the emissions, it comes down to this. In Europe, 30 to 50 parts per million of sulfur. In the U.S., 500 parts per million of sulfur. We have the dirtiest diesel in the developed world. In 2007, the EPA has mandated ultra-low sulfur diesel for the entire country. That will drop the sulfur down to 15 parts per million, lower than Europe, and that allows us to put emission control devices on those diesel vehicles that will bring those emissions down below gas vehicles while getting more miles per gallon and for efficiency. So this is something to think about. And this could very well be a trend. You look at the motor industry and you look at some of the people talking about what's going on. Is diesel going to catch on in the U.S.? Is it going to come back? A lot of people think that it may. Annual consumption of biodiesel in gallons. In Europe, 250 million gallons per year. In the U.S., 15 million gallons per year last year. In 2000, the consumption of biodiesel in the U.S. was zero. This market is growing very quickly. They're estimating 40 to 50 million gallons this year. Source of feedstock oil for biodiesel, rapeseed in Europe, which is canola, which what we know is canola here in the U.S. In the U.S., it's largely soy. Rapeseed is a better oil for bio-based lubricants, is a better oil for biodiesel. Europeans understand that. The soy industry is a huge lobby in this country. There is a huge glut of soybean oil in the Midwest because we're not doing a good job of competing with Brazil. And so it needs to go somewhere. It goes into biodiesel. Now, I'll say that in the U.S., for biofuels, huge companies like ADM are very significant, and they push legislation at the federal level. Oregon and Washington and Northwest states are going to have to ride the coattails of those companies, and that's probably a good thing. However, we have an opportunity to produce rapeseed, canola. Soy will not grow very well in the Northwest. Rapeseed grows exceptionally well. And we've talked to grass seed farmers in the Valley and Eastern Oregon wheat farmers about growing canola in rotation. It's a very interesting proposition. It breaks the pest cycle. There's some opportunities there. So, markets for diesel and gasoline, this is significant. When you think about the fuel that we use in this country and the amount of money that we spend and how that revolves in the, through the economy, in the U.S., 57 billion gallons of diesel consumed in the U.S. in 2002. There was about 35 billion gallons on road. Gasoline's about twice that, 100 billion gallons. In Oregon, all of that is imported. We don't have any refineries here. We don't have any oil wells here. It's all imported. All that money that pays for that fuel is exported. Gallons consumed in Oregon each year, 720 million gallons of diesel fuel and about 1.4 billion gallons of gasoline. So, and then if you break that down into gallons per day, about 2 million gallons of diesel on road in Oregon each day, 4 million gallons of gasoline. Okay, and what I want to get to here is looking at Minnesota, which is what Representative Krupp mentioned. Minnesota, in 1985, mandated 10% ethanol in all their on-road gasoline. You go to Minnesota, you buy a gallon of gas, you get 10% ethanol. Sometimes in Oregon, if it's blended and it's actually cheaper to blend ethanol into gasoline at certain times of the year, you might get it here. In Minnesota, every gallon you're going to get is 10%. And what has that done for Minnesota? It's generated 14 ethanol production facilities in Minnesota. Most of those facilities produce about 15 million gallons per year, which is sort of a moderate-sized facility. Most are farmer-owned co-ops. They grow the grain, they process the grain, they sell the ethanol. They're a net exporter of ethanol. Every gallon of that ethanol that's consumed in Minnesota was produced in Minnesota, generates $12 of revenue for every dollar that they invested, and they export to other states. I guarantee you we buy ethanol from Minnesota and Oregon. Biodiesel, 2% biodiesel in all on-road diesel fuel in Minnesota. This was a law that was passed about a year ago in Minnesota. It will start in 2005. Minnesota has soybean farmers. Minnesota has an 8 million gallon per year plant, biodiesel plant under construction in Minnesota. That 2% biodiesel in Minnesota will be produced in Minnesota. It will benefit Minnesota farmers. This is an opportunity that we could also capitalize upon here in Oregon. So markets for biofuels. In the U.S., 15 million gallons of biodiesel consumed last year, 2.2 billion gallons of ethanol consumed last year. The ethanol industry projects 5 billion gallons of ethanol by 2012. And that is largely the California market that's going away from MTBE into ethanol. That is a significant market. Gallons consumed in Oregon, about 150,000 gallons of biodiesel. Biodiesel did not come into Oregon until a year ago. It came into Portland about a year ago. In a year, about 150,000 gallons. That's growing. About 20 million gallons of ethanol. I'm not totally firm on that number, but I think that's a pretty close number in Oregon. So that's what's come in and blended in Oregon. Now, if we were to look at something like Minnesota, just for the sake of argument, 10% ethanol in Oregon, 146 million gallons of ethanol. The one plant in Clatskanie is looking to produce 100 million gallons. And that's using Northwest corn. We have to work on the feedstock issue, but there is a huge market for ethanol, and that's only Oregon. That doesn't include California. The California market is about 10 times the market in Oregon. California has the eighth largest economy in the world, and it takes a lot of fuel to fuel that economy. If we were to go to 2% biodiesel in Oregon, 15 million gallons, that's a significant amount of biodiesel, and that fuel could be produced in the state. That could be 2% of diesel fuel that benefits Oregon farmers, benefits the Northwest. Policy mandates and incentives. Largely, biodiesel has been used because of the Environmental Policy Act of 1992. Most biodiesel is 20% blended, and it's consumed by state and federal fleets. Governments have gotten started. I believe DAS is using 20%. They put a bid out about 2 months ago, and I believe that they closed that bid and they're using 20% biodiesel. In Eugene, City of Eugene is using this fuel. University of Oregon is using this fuel. Lane County is using this fuel. It's totally proven. There's no question. It reduces emissions. It's all there. Ethanol blender's credit. This is why ethanol is 2.2 billion gallons per year. And this, they always try, and at the federal level, they talk about taking this away, and then ADM steps in, and it stays. This credit is not going anywhere with ADM lobbying to keep it. Mm-hmm. Executive Order 13149, this is just another example. This is a presidential executive order. Established a goal for federal agencies to reduce annual fleet petroleum use by 20% by 2005. It also seeks to increase the number of alternative fuel vehicles and the use of alternative fuels in agency fleet vehicles. So this has been mandated to the federal agencies, and this is kicking in. Fuel tax incentive legislation in the federal Senate. I mentioned Representative Chuck Grassley from Iowa, Finance Committee Chair. He proposed a bill last year for the energy bill that would drop the federal fuel tax on 20% biodiesel by 20 cents a gallon. Actually, it would be a penny per percentage up to 20%. You use 2% biodiesel, you drop it 2 cents. You use 20% biodiesel, you drop it 20 cents. That stalled at the end of Congress last year. It's been reintroduced, and it's passed the Finance Committee in the Senate again, and now it's moving through the House again, or through the Senate again. It's a long road, but there's a lot of support for this, especially given the situation in the Middle East. If this were to pass, biodiesel would be basically on par. Blended biodiesel would be on parity with diesel fuel. It would be cheaper in the Midwest. It would be slightly more expensive in the Northwest. If we could produce in the Northwest, it would be cheaper in the Northwest. Renewable fuel standard. This is something that's always bouncing around at the federal level to talk about creating a certain amount of biofuels or alternative fuels that would have to be included in the total consumption in the U.S. every year, and that's something that may be on the outside. And then carbon emission credit tax or trading, this is something that isn't well developed. It's not mandated or really put into place by the federal government. But here in the Northwest, there are actually groups in Oregon that have started doing this on the private scale. Seattle City Lights has gone out and bought carbon reductions, right? There's a couple groups in Lake Oswego and Portland that actually trade carbon emissions. This is relating to global warming. This is relating to the Kyoto Protocol. The federal government has not taken it upon themselves to do this, but the market is driving itself to create value in reducing carbon emissions. Last thing I want to cover here is biorefining. Representative Krupp mentioned that these bills would cover biofuels, biodiesel and ethanol, and also biooils. Fuel is a huge market, as I showed, billions and billions of gallons. But it is the commodity. It is the major commodity in this country, which means that the prices are very, very low and the margins are very, very small. So there's an opportunity to start there. However, anything you can make from a petroleum molecule, you can make from a vegetable oil molecule. And the vegetable oil molecule is actually better in many respects than the petroleum molecule. Representative Krupp mentioned the lubricity in sulfur. I mentioned that sulfur will drop from 500 parts per million down to 15 parts per million when we go to ultra-low sulfur. Taking sulfur out of diesel is like taking lead out of gas. You lose the lubricity, so you have to add it back in. The lubricity of biodiesel, if you took that sample and you try that, it's more like vegetable oil than it is like diesel. Diesel will dry out your hands. That will not dry out your hands. 2% biodiesel replaces the lubricity that's taken out with sulfur when the sulfur is dropped down. The same is true if you look at lubricants for the sawmill industry. There are a number of sawmills using canola-based lubricants because they stand up better to heat and they're biodegradable. They're not as difficult to handle and whatnot. So bio-based products, looking at lubricants, hydraulic oils. The Metafoam Growers Association has developed a hydraulic oil that they're trying to get going, I think, with the U.S. Navy. Again, these products are biodegradable and non-toxic, and in a marine environment especially, they're very attractive. Solvents, cleaners, and paints. Again, I'll mention, I've been talking a lot about the Oregon market. Representative Krupp mentioned the California market, eighth largest economy in the world. California tends to be the most progressive state environmentally. They tend to implement these kinds of ideas and adopt these kinds of products more than before any other state. They set the bar. And yet they don't produce these crops, these industrial crops, because their land is too high value. They produce something else instead. There is a great opportunity for the Northwest to produce these types of products. There's also a great opportunity for farmers to be involved in the value-added side of these products, not producing commodity oil, but producing finished products that go to market. And I think the Metafoam growers have experimented with trying to do that. Final thing. Vision for the future, because, you know, I was listening to NPR as I was driving up here, and today, 50 years ago today, Watson and Crick published their paper that identified DNA as the molecule that carries genetic information. 50 years ago today. How much has our lives changed in the last 50 years? 50 years ago was the nuclear age. It was the age of chemistry and the age of physics. We are clearly entering the age of biology, biological engineering. Biological systems perform functions that we can manage. They work for us. We don't have to do the work. They work for us. We manage them. 50 years from now, our world is going to look very different, just like it looked very different 50 years ago. So giving some sense of vision and the future and where Oregon's going to be included in that future, I think, is really important, especially for me. I'm the old guy in the room, right? But I'm going to be, you know, this is important to me for myself and for my children and my grandchildren. So the vision for the future, we're going to decrease dependence on petroleum. We're going to transition to other products over time. It may take 40 or 50 years, but we're going to do that. We should start today. Petroleum's like money in the bank, right? But we should be investing that money in a future energy resource that's going to be there for us when petroleum runs out. Encourage conservation. This is about using biofuels that cycle the energy, about using technology like diesel technology that's more efficient, because just like petroleum is money in the bank, a penny saved is a penny earned. A gallon of diesel fuel or a gallon of gasoline that isn't used is a gallon we can use for something else later down the road. And I think you're seeing the market sort of push itself a little bit like this, as it is in Europe, in more efficient, more fuel-efficient cars, hybrids and whatnot. increase energy efficiency, again, same type of thing, more miles per gallon. Transition to renewable, less polluting forms of energy. This is good for the environment. This is good socially in terms of health and air quality for people, especially when I was reading something the other day. By 2025, 75% of all the world's population will live in cities. That is where waste is concentrated. That's where people are concentrated. This is extremely important over the next 25 years. Transition to more decentralized production and distribution systems. And we're seeing this with electricity. We're seeing this in distributed generation, wind generation, generation of like biomass generation, biogas. This is the biological model. This is don't transport everything so far, create the energy closer to the source. This is where we're going. And I think that these bills and looking at biofuels, creating some incentives, you know, these don't build biodiesel or ethanol production facilities, but they provide incentives for private businesses, not necessarily my business, but other businesses to come in and use these so that they can make this happen. And I think that's really the best use of government, to create that incentive and let the private sector step up and make that happen. That's it. I really appreciate your time, and if you have questions, I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right. Are there questions for Mr. Endicott? Reactions?
Well, Mr. Chair,
very informative overview.
I would like to kind of close up our portion of the presentation here. I think Thomas really hit the nail on the head. It's what we're trying to do is lay a foundation for the future in these two small bills in terms of providing that small incentive. Now, in House Bill 3551, clearly I have proposed changing the 50% property tax credit to 100% for a 10-year period. If that is not palatable, I am willing to reconsider staying at the 50% level. But I think it is extremely important that we extend the period to 10 years. And why is that? Because when you go out and get a loan to build one of these facilities, as part of your business model, you need to be able to consider a 10-year payback on that. There is no mandates in what we're trying to achieve here. Part of the success of the Minnesota program was that they put in place a mandate and incentives at the same time. We want to take a little different approach. We want to offer the incentives because we know that there are people who see the value, and you'll hear from one of them soon, who is building a plant here. They see the value of locating a plant here for strategic reasons in Oregon. This is great for rural development. You're typically not going to put one of these facilities in downtown Portland. You're going to put these facilities in places where you are closer to the raw product, whether it's bringing 160-car, 120-car unit trains out of the Midwest with corn to produce ethanol currently, or growing our own. You need to have these facilities located, and they create jobs, and they create pretty good jobs, and they help stimulate rural economies. Since we have initially, let me backtrack. This ethanol statute's never been used. We've never built a plant here in Oregon before. They'll be breaking ground here shortly, I believe in July, on the Klatskanine facility. 2 weeks ago, Senator Dave Nelson, Representative Greg Smith, and I met with a gentleman and his legal staff, who is an investor, who is looking at building another ethanol facility in the Pendleton area. Again, being close to what could potentially be a cheap product for the future. There is also a group of gentlemen who participated in our task force who are interested in building a biodiesel, bio-oils production facility in the Umatilla-Hermiston area. So clearly there are people who are thinking this direction, and they really would like to move forward. And there have been some barriers, and some of them are cost issues. But clearly, if we can do something to offer an incentive, we can lay this foundation that we can build on in the future. The governor's office, in my early discussions with them, has been very supportive of biofuels concepts. We have not yet talked about the specifics of the legislation we're bringing forward out of the task force. We hope to do that very soon. There's another really interesting twist to all of this. The cheapest way to produce biodiesel is not to go out and buy canola from a farmer like me. The cheapest way to do it today is to go to a restaurant and get waste grease, or to a rendering facility that takes care of the rendering from a slaughterhouse. problem is we don't have any slaughterhouses in Oregon. I have another bill that will be coming to this committee, most likely, Mr. Chair, that deals with incentives from Oregon Economic and Community Development to allow priority consideration for a short number of years to build slaughterhouses in the state of Oregon. How could that benefit the biofuels industry? If you have slaughterhouses and they have a lot of animal carcass that they have to render, if you could turn those into biodiesel at the same time, marry the two concepts together, we can do a lot more for rural development. We can do a lot more for our farm and ranch families that raise meat of all types in Oregon but have to send their animals outside of the state to have the meat processed. Here's an opportunity for us to marry another concept that will be coming to you together to create kind of a holistic opportunity to do some really neat things for rural Oregon. The types of crops that we grow here are that would be good for ethanol clearly is corn. But think also of the grass seed straw that guys like me burn or plow under. With the coming technology and research that's being done on cellulose breakdown, we could turn that into the basic building block for ethanol. Some of our wood chips. All of these could be developed for that market. Canola. Today, it is cheaper to buy canola from Canada and crush it than it is for us to grow canola here in Oregon. Now, part of that has to do with the fact that there is a Canadian subsidy in effect, but there's also the exchange rate that there is between our two countries. If we can conduct research, and that is the missing element to this picture that I'm trying to paint for you today, if we can conduct research, for instance, we know that dryland canola farming on the east side of the mountains produces half of what we can produce on the west side. And that's dryland on the west side. That isn't including intensive irrigation or intensive agricultural practices. If we can produce higher yielding varieties of mustard, of canola, and perhaps do the research, and as Thomas indicated, into the saltwater algae, we can bring the cost of the raw material down, allow the farmer to make a profit, and provide that missing piece to the puzzle that we need. The California market is huge. Let me give you just a sense of that. If you took all the diesel in California and you blended just 2% of it with biodiesel grown in Oregon, it would take most of the acres of intensive production we have in the entire state on a yearly basis. Now, that's not likely to happen in any scenario. However, we have 4.5 million productive acres in Oregon, and part of Oregon's agricultural problem today is that only really two segments of Oregon agriculture are doing well, and that's nursery and Christmas trees. And they are beginning to be overproduced because traditional commodity type farming that we have been encouraged here in the valley and that we have on the east side is simply overproduced. That's a reality of why we have low prices in our markets in the West Coast. If we could take even 500,000 acres out of the 4.5 million and dedicate that to alternative fuels production and alternative oils, it would make a tremendous positive impact on what the farmer can get in return and our ability to keep rural economies and rural communities viable in this state. And we can do it through a free market concept. And that's what these bills try to achieve, is that little incentive to begin the foundation, just as they did in Minnesota 10 years ago. They've been very successful there, and we can do this here. The future of the California market, the future of what we can grow and produce and use in Oregon is very bright for these products. But if we do not offer an incentive, it will be difficult to expand this market beyond. And you'll hear again from additional testimony about the plans that are for the future. And, Mr. Chair, with that, I will take any questions, as I'm sure Tom.
Yes, Representative Farr.
Thank you. Representative Krupp, you're talking about a 10-year 100% credit on the production or
As the bill is currently written, yes.
As the bill is currently written. Clearly, we have a growth industry here, or opportunity for a growth industry, and certainly some form of incentive on our part is going to help things move along a little bit faster. Has there been any discussion at all of a phased-out percentage, starting perhaps at 100 and gradually phasing out at perhaps 50, at the same time maybe being coupled with a phased-in mandate of a mixture of fuels?
And Mr. Chair, and Representative Farr, good question. We have not had discussions in terms of the phase issue. Mm-hmm. We have talked about mandates, and we did talk about mandates in the biofuels task force. We thought, frankly, it was too far of a stretch for us to go in this first session. Our friends in the oil industry don't like mandates, clearly. And we think that if we can provide the right incentives, it may not be necessary to ever have a mandate in the state of Oregon. We think that the free market will dictate the use of the fuels. Part of that means that we have a cost structure that resembles what they've been able to achieve in Minnesota, where actually at certain times of the year you will get ethanol that is cheaper than unleaded gasoline for various reasons. And we think that we can achieve that, and that was frankly was our thought in, although we didn't have broad agreement on it in our task force, but generally we've decided not to go the mandate route. And I am not opposed to chatting with any of the members of the committee in trying to make and come to an equitable agreement here. Obviously, if to our local counties, if you're going to provide 100% tax exemption for a facility of this type, there's no revenue to them. The original statute is at 50% for 5 years. So if your incentive creates a facility, then the county gets some revenue for some period of time. And I wouldn't be opposed, again, to negotiating that to find an equitable solution here. I think it's very important we move forward. I think the 10-year time frame is important, though, because you have to have a business plan and a model that you can take to the bank. And when you're talking about the production facility that the gentleman will be, the 100-million-gallon facility that he'll be talking about in a moment, is very, very expensive. And this means a lot to them in terms of incentive.
Other questions? One that I had, and maybe not for you, and maybe for somebody else who will be coming up here, but the connection between the bill we heard yesterday, what was it, the strategic investment program, expansion of the enterprise zone. I'd be interested to know whether our potential production facilities have looked at that as a vehicle for an exemption from taxation. I know we expanded we're looking at the expansion of the strategic investment program to include rural, particularly reduces the investment requirement to qualify, and specifically addresses energy production, which I would expect this would fall under. So we may want to look at that too as a vehicle for creating incentive and an opportunity for encouraging production of ethanol as well, because I think that may come under the amendments we were looking at in that bill yesterday.
Okay.
So, what was the number, Paul?
2299.
2299, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be happy to look at that. I'm unaware of that legislation, how it may affect.
We just saw it yesterday for the first time, too.
Well, Mr. Chair, it would lower that SIP cap to $25 million. I was the very same thing.
Right. The investment required to qualify is $25 million. It creates special provision in rural areas. Also
designed for energy.
It was
facilities.
Energy facilities. Yeah.
There are, Mr. Chair, and Michael Graney can expound on this further. His office, by the way, was very helpful in the task force in showing us a matrix of the various tax credits on the federal and state level, and identifying where there are perhaps some overlaps, where there are some prohibitions against using both one at the state and federal level, but also identifying some gaps. And what we're trying to do with these two pieces of legislation is in some small way fill in the gaps to try to provide a more holistic view of trying to start this industry here in Oregon.
Good. Any other questions for these two? We've got some other witnesses we'll need to get to. Mazin, did you have something?
Just a technical question, Mr. Chair. I remember with the ethanol requirement by the federal government for the 10% blending, the specification was it's in the winter time because it is then when the emissions are reduced, while if you mix in the summer, actually the ozonation level goes up and it is more harmful to the environment than not mixing. Is biodiesel have the same issue between summer and winter mixing with diesel?
I don't believe that it does. I haven't heard. I know more about biodiesel than ethanol, and I haven't heard that. The emissions, I think, are pretty much straight across the board. What is the emission that increases for ethanol in the summertime?
In the summertime, is the ozone gases, basically.
Oh, okay. Biodiesel, the only major increase in ozone-type gases is NOx emissions, and that's consistent across summer and winter. And that will actually be reduced once the ultra-low sulfur diesel comes in and they start to reduce emissions with pollution control devices. That will be reduced at that time.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Let's hear from Charles Carlson. Good morning, Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Charles Carlson. I'm president of Cascade Grain, which is the West Coast plant for American ethanol, and we're the plant that's looking at being built in Clatskanie. The one question you had on summer, the biggest problem in the summer is not the contamination of the ozone, it's the vapor pressure of the gas gets too high, which can cause stalling. That's why when you look at RFG down in California, then they get down to a 5.7 blend rather than a 10% blend to reduce the vapor pressure to where levels that it should be.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
You know,
I don't know why he didn't answer.
We knew all that.
We're the revenue committee.
All right.
Yeah. Does biodiesel have the same problem?
No, that's not a vapor pressure issue there. But it could get accomplished by reducing the percentage of ethanol and it still reduces pollutions considerably during the summer, and that's, of course, you go to Minnesota, that's why they have the 10% ethanol blend there. The Port Westward facility, what I would like to say where we are, what we're doing there, will be a 100 million gallon per year facility. It will also create over 300,000 tons of distiller dry grain, and that's a high protein feed for the livestock industry. And we'll produce around 240,000 of carbon dioxide that will be used for the beverage industry and also for the industrial uses. For ethanol usage in Oregon, I went to the annual reports that are filed by the petroleum terminals in Portland for the Portland terminals, and in 2001 we actually brought in over 48 million gallons of ethanol into the Portland terminal areas. In talking to the ethanol traders in the industry, they feel roughly that between Oregon and Washington somewhere around 150 million gallons of ethanol is used. And West Coast, with the California putting ethanol ban in, we're close to a billion gallons of ethanol being used. This site we have looked at, and we feel one of the premier sites in the country because we can economically bring the corn out, produce the ethanol here, because we save the freight on the ethanol, because we have a viable livestock industry. And what you're seeing now in the Midwest is they're have already overpopulated, basically, ethanol plants in that part of the country and have to export both the ethanol and the distiller dry grains. And back in the Midwest right now, it's almost impossible to get a CO2 contract and get a plant to coexist along with you. So they vent the CO2 into the atmosphere. These are some of the reasons why this plant is economical to be built out here. Where we run into problems beyond just the straight economics is what state incentives are being offered back in the Midwest that hamper this plant from being built out here. If you go into Minnesota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Iowa, they have a variety of incentives that are offered based on the state. Some of our sales tax exemptions, if they have sales tax on equipment, they offer 10-year real estate tax exemptions like 3551. They also have production credits, and that's some of the biggest ones were plants, like they were saying, a 15-million-gallon plant, and some states were getting 20 cents a gallon. So a plant back in the Midwest will get state additional state incentives of anywhere from $3 to $5 million. And that's when we talk to our finance people and we talk to the equity people that are trying to back this plant. They say, how can you overcome those state incentives that are offered in the Midwest? Of course, one of the things we say is because where we're siting the plant, and for the reasons that I said before, you know, there is an economic value from this plant being built here versus the Midwest. But we have to fight those state incentives, and that's why I'm here today to support this legislation, to get some state incentives so that we can go back to our investors and say, yeah, they are looking at it. We will produce, with the CO2 plant, 80 jobs out there approximately in a county that right now has roughly 12% unemployment. During construction, there will be close to a 500,000 man hours in construction time, both on-site and prefabbed off-site, that will be done here. So we are creating an industry out here that will provide valuable construction jobs at a time when it's desperately needed, long-term good family wage jobs. And we were providing, again, ethanol for the environment to blend with the gas here in Oregon, and also for distillate dry grains for the livestock industry. This is an industry that is benefiting the whole state. And what we are looking at, you know, through these is sometime in state incentives that we can come back to our investors and say, yes, they're looking at promoting ethanol out in the West Coast and they want a plant here. And you know, just you can go on through this thing. All our major permits are in place. We're part of the Port of St. Helens NPDES permit, which just was finally went through its appeal period. We have our air quality permit, so we're well permitted. We're down the road this quite a ways on this project, and we expect groundbreaking here, like I said, toward the end of July, August time frame is what they're looking at. And Representative Krupp said back in the Midwest, yes, ethanol right now. As of Friday, the average rack price was in the five states back in Minnesota was around the $1.28 a gallon. Back in the Midwest, you see signs where 10% blended ethanol is 6 cents a gallon under regular unleaded gas. And it also helps in octane enhancing. The National Renewable Energy Lab came out on biodiesel, for example, one of the best blends in diesel for both smog reduction is a combination of 10% ethanol, 10% biodiesel, and 80% regular diesel. So we use it also in diesel. Some places they use it up to 15% ethanol in diesel to reduce smog by and add oxygen to the diesel. So it has a number of advantages when it comes to both diesel and gasoline. And I put in your packet in front of you just what does an ethanol plant look like. And this is about a 40-million-gallon plant back in the Midwest. Ours will be 100, so it'll be roughly twice the size. But they're very nice-looking plants, very low polluting. The air quality permit that we have is of what's called a minor synthetic, so we're not a Title V major emitter. Of course, we're putting it out there on the old Army, Beaver Army base. They've been through it before. The other gentleman covered pretty much what we use ethanol for. It's clean burning, it's renewable, it's domestic, and we use it for both oxygenate plus for octane. It's a high octane additive, so the petroleum industry can use ethanol, which is in the 113 to 116 octane range, to upgrade regular lower grade gas to a higher grade. And again, we went through this whole. Put through their ethanol usage. We covered there also the typical 10% blend. We use it in oxygenate 5.7 and 7.7 for RFG, smog ozone reduction down in California. The RFG is we'll take about a 5.7, and that gets it down to where you can get the vapor pressure down so you don't cause a problem. And oxygenate fuel requirements in wintertime for carbon monoxide reduction, there it's 7.7% reduction. So it comes in different blends, comes in different percentages for specific reasons. Again, we're looking at MTB being replaced. There's been some major lawsuits filed against the industry for contamination of water sources from MTBE, and that was one of the reasons why California put their ban in effect going into effect January 2004. But the petroleum industry beat that imposed limit deadline, and right now they expect to blend pretty close to 80% of the gas down there this year with ethanol rather than MTBE. Basically, something to stay away from that liability. They expect to use over 600 million gallons of ethanol in California this coming year, this year that we're in, before the ban actually takes place. Many states are banning the MTBE, and that's in this brochure also. So far, Oregon, from what I understand, doesn't have a ban, but California does and Washington does. And, of course, in the RFS, it will come a federal ban on it if that goes through. And a portion of that has passed the House here recently in H.R. 6, I believe it is. So it'll be going to a joint subcommittee here before too long. But a local West Coast ethanol market, we expect that pretty soon will be in the area of nearly a billion gallons, both California, Oregon, Washington, and also Alaska. Alaska in the Anchorage is a non-attainment area and requires ethanol. So this facility will be well-placed for suiting Alaska's needs because we can barge it up there by ocean-going barges. Actually, there's also some interest in Hawaii because they have currently working on a ban on MTBE barging ethanol from this plant over to Hawaii. A lot of your ethanol right now comes from the Midwest, but it also comes from the Caribbean. Under the Caribbean Initiative, there's roughly 60 to 70 million gallons of ethanol that comes into the United States. A lot of that has, in the past, come to the West Coast. But as the RFS moves forward, that, from a freight advantage, will move more to the Gulf, more to the East Coast, and more of the Midwest ethanol then will come to the West Coast, or from plants that are getting built out here. For distiller dry grain, of course, excellent for the cattle feed. We expect not only a lot of it to be used around here, theoretically, look at the market, we can use much more than this plant will produce. But as we're looking at a protein cost-wise, we're looking also as an export market. And my background is in the commodity area. And, you know, West Coast over the years has the corn exports have dramatically decreased as, of course, China's exports to Pacific Rim countries have increased and taken that market share away from us. The people that I have talked to are looking at distiller dry grains as a high protein replacement. We go over into Pacific Rim, so we're looking at that being as a developing market, replacing some of that lost corn export market that we've seen. And basically, we think it's a very well-sited plant. We're looking for some additional incentives, mainly to counteract some of the other incentives that are offered by Midwest states to site plants in their states. So I would like you to support, of course, for 3551 and 3278 or whatever other can come up in support of ethanol and biodiesel as renewable fuels in this state.
All right. Other questions? Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You described the Midwest environment for these kinds of plants as I think it got overbuilt.
Mm-hmm.
How long do you expect it to take for places like Oregon, Washington to get to the point where they've basically saturated the market? Or the supply line, or whatever the place is where the shortage is going to show up?
Well, a lot is being developed down the road that will expand ethanol usage. You know, when you look at fuel cell technology, GM has a well-to-wheel greenhouse gas program, and they've looked at all types of fuels. They say some of the most least polluting fuel cell would be an ethanol fuel cell. But that's going to take cellulosic ethanol, as was described here, because of the quantities that would just need just overstrip what we can do from corn at the current time. But out here we're easily, you know, at the 150, 200 million gallon level. But you take like in South Dakota, which probably only uses about 40, 50 million gallons internally, with the plants that are currently under construction, will produce over 400 million gallons. And of course they have to look then as where do they export it, primarily of course to California. A lot of it's coming currently out here. A lot of distiller dry grain is being coming out here because they've over produced to meet what the livestock needs are back in the Midwest in that area.
Then I'm done. What are the odds of this plant being built, whether this bill passes or not?
We hope, you know, as we talked, they're going to New York next week to try and finalize the term sheets. One of the biggest questions they can look at our site economics and see site to site, is that issue of state incentives.
and it does come to play quite a lot. We're trying to get around it. I don't know how successful they will be. From an economic standpoint, I think this plant should be built here.
Question we asked on the last night, have you looked at the Enterprise Zone, the Strategic Investment Program, the change? You're probably not aware either of the changes being underway on that. I would encourage you to look at that for whatever you're taking back to Washington to or New York to present some possible need incentives.
We have looked with and talked with Columbia County on the Enterprise Zone. Actually, if I were to say my best brothers would be a production credit, because that's where the biggest dollars come from back in the Midwest, where there a lot of those credits amount to $2-3 million just on based on gallonage produced from ethanol, and they come out of the state gasoline tax taxes. But that's what we're facing. We're facing $3-5 million of state incentives that are given to plants back there that we don't have access to here.
Other questions? Representative Barr, were you going to?
No.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's hear then from Mike Graney and Brian. Did you want to come? Brian Doerr, did you want to testify on this? You're just here to. Okay. Mike Graney.
Morning, Mr. Chairman. Mike Graney, Director of the Office of Energy. And I will be brief, Mr. Chairman, because I think Representative Krupp and the other speakers gave a good explanation for support of the bill. Office of Energy also supports the bill and the amendment. And I have had a chance to raise this bill with the governor's office. The governor's office staff is also supportive of the bill. Let me mention that we have, in addition to the Columbia County project that you just heard about, our office has been contacted, and we've had discussions over the last year or so with two other smaller projects that would be in eastern Oregon. Probably $10 to $20 million in size each, but even the smaller projects would be important to those rural communities. We think this is a good bill, and we think it's good energy policy and it's good environmental policy for the reasons you've heard already. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for that. Concise testimony. Any questions for Mr. Graney?
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's bring up the county guys. Gil Riddell and Tom Lynn Harris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. I have with me Tom Lynn Harris, who's a Columbia County assessor, who will have some details about the activities, successful activities in Columbia County. The alternative fuels sound very promising, and we're very encouraged by the federal incentives that were listed and the mandate in California that will create the market. And we note that proponents are mentioning the market is driving itself, and that's very, very encouraging. It certainly has a future. Before Tom comments, however, I have 3 points to make about the proposed method of supporting the industry in this bill. First, it is a property tax expenditure that local government did not ask for, yet it spends scarce local revenues for general essential purposes, public services, and also spends local school money. Secondly, this bill isn't needed. With the federal incentives and regulations, with the California mandates and the market, this industry seems to have a very promising future. But I also want to point out that currently existing state and local tools for economic development, combined with local initiatives, have been successful. We have a real-life instance in Columbia County that Tom can describe. We have a strategic investment initiative program, enterprise zones, and even urban renewal can come into play as it did in Columbia County. And third, we're concerned that if this bill passes as is, it will disrupt the total package in Columbia County and also negotiations there for two power projects. So with that, I'll let Tom describe the details.
All right.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Lynn Harris, and I'm the Columbia County Assessor, and I'm actually wearing two hats today. I'm here representing the Oregon State Association of County Assessors, and I'm also here representing Columbia County. Let me start with my comments regarding the association's view of the bill. The one concern that we have, and I appreciate Representative Krupp's willingness to look at this, but if you go from 50% to 100% exemption, unlike all other economic development exemption programs, many of which you heard about yesterday, this removes value from the role that was there before the facility was proposed. I'm speaking specifically of the land. This bill, taking it to 100%, exempts the land, all the buildings, all the machinery equipment, the personal property. So value that was already on the roll would be taken off. So not only would you not give local taxing districts the benefit of new revenue from new construction, but you would actually reduce revenue by reducing value off the roll. No other economic development incentive provides that level of exemption. Land is essentially taxed under all of those other programs. Leaving this at the 50% exemption would solve that problem, obviously. So I would, that's the one point I would make. The second point I would make is that in reading this, I don't see any prohibition against a company getting, for example, an enterprise zone exemption for 3 or 5 years and then getting the 10 years exemption under this statute. And I think I'm not saying that could happen, but I don't see anything that would prevent it. The language of the bill is somewhat archaic, actually. There's some sections to it that don't make sense to me from a property tax exemption administration standpoint. But I don't see anything that would prevent a company from double dipping and getting the enterprise zone exemption as well as this exemption and stretching it out 13 or even 15 years. So it'd be good if we could clean that up. So I'll take my association hat off now and put on my Columbia County representative hat. We are very excited about the Cascade Grain project for the Port Westward industrial site just north of Clatskanie. The construction jobs, the permanent jobs are all very much needed, particularly in that end of the county where they don't have the opportunity to commute to Portland. The Port Westward area has been one of the crown jewels of bare industrial land in the state for many years. The problem with it has been infrastructure. It's isolated. The roads are terrible. Every time the governor went out there to talk about an economic development project, he always took a helicopter. Well, I made the comment, the best way to get the road fixed is make the governor drive out there. There's water, there's rail, there's all sorts of infrastructure. In order to finally, after so many years, develop the Port Westward site, the Port of St. Helens, Columbia County, City of Clatskanie got together and formed an urban renewal district for the Port Westward area. They've identified $34 million in infrastructure cost that need to be made to make the site desirable for industrial tenants. That plan is in place. There's not a whole lot of revenue coming in yet, but with the prospects of Cascade Grain and two other power projects, it looks like that's what urban renewal was supposed to be. That's how it's supposed to work, and hopefully it'll work out very, very well. In addition to the urban renewal plan, we have the enterprise zone available for that area. Cascade Grain has negotiated with Columbia County a 5-year enterprise zone exemption in exchange for compensating their employees at a family wage level, which is good. Based on the economic analysis that was done by the Port of St. Helens analyst, during the first 5 years, the company will pay $631,000 in taxes, and they will save $5,375,000 in taxes. So they get a substantial tax abatement under the 5-year enterprise zone program. Over the 10-year period, the company will pay $6,328,000 in taxes.
I'm sorry, how much?
$6,328,000. Mm-hmm. And they will save, from the first 5 years, $5,374,000 for a total of $11,700,000. Under this bill as currently written, they would pay zero taxes. They would have abated $11,700,000 in taxes over a 10-year period. We think that's awfully generous. In addition, what it does is the whole financing of that $34 million through the urban renewal plan is contingent on certain revenues coming in from the project, and it throws those numbers all off if you're going to give them an $11,700,000 tax abatement as opposed to a $5,375,000 tax abatement. That's what Gil was referring to when he said it might disrupt. And the whole financing package is sort of geared on those numbers, and this bill would change all those numbers substantially. So that's Columbia County's concern, and we only heard about this bill Friday. So I'm not even sure the Port of St. Helens, who has taken the lead in developing the Port Westwood site, they own the land. I'm not even sure they're aware of the bill yet. So those are Columbia County's concerns, and I was asked by Commissioner Tony Hyde to present those to you this morning. Again, I was glad to hear Representative Krupp being willing to talk about some of these things, because I think the bill in its present form simply doesn't work either from a state level or from Columbia County standpoint.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I think this is utterly obvious, but I want to be certain I understand. You're talking about putting $34 million into infrastructure, which in effect makes the plants that we're talking about usable. Is that right, or have I misunderstood that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that's exactly correct.
Okay, thank you.
Well, and what else was in this urban renewal plan area? What else are you contemplating?
Infrastructure or?
No, development.
There's two power companies. There's a Brett Wilcox, and Summit Power is proposing a, I can't remember the megawatts, essentially a gas-fired generation facility, and PGE is contemplating a gas-fired generation facility as well.
Okay. Sounds like something to work through. Questions on that?
Well, just one more. Mm-hmm. Could you give us a thumbnail on how you plan to finance the $34 million at the current time without this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, urban renewal plans are tricky. If you build it, if you build it, they will come.
Yeah.
But if they don't come, you can't afford to build it. So it's really sort of a company commits, they start construction, and then, okay, we know we're going to have some money on the roll, which, because of the urban renewal, all that additional revenue goes to the urban renewal district. Okay, we know we're going to have in 5 years, once the five-year enterprise zone exemption expires, we know we're going to be getting some revenue, so now we can pay for the first phase of the road and the rail, because obviously they can't get the corn in there unless they have, adequate rail. The second company commits, starts construction. Okay, now we know we're going to have some more money, so now we can do phase two of the road improvements and extend the rail further into the site. So it's a real balancing act in terms of when you commit. You can't really commit to paying for it because Columbia, if you think the state's broke, you've got to see Columbia County. We absolutely do not have the money for the infrastructure improvements without these companies coming on board and kicking in money from the urban renewal division of tax calculations. So it's
and then if I could follow up, then I assume that you're bonding that income stream in order to pay for those improvements.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that's correct.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Are there other questions? Anything else? Tom, Gil, Representative Krupp, do you want to come forward? Come on up, sure. Why don't you stay there in case we have any conversation here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, State Representative Jeff Krupp, House District 17. In response to a couple of the concerns raised here, I did not intend this legislation to create any of the ancillary issues that obviously a potential impact it has in the urban renewal issues out there. I would be happy to address the double-dipping issue and any other that would create the problems for them in this project. I would also... You need to also understand that strategic investment, if I'm understanding correctly, Mr. Chair, that lowers the cap to $25 million?
In House Bill 2199, it does. The investment requirement to qualify has dropped to $25 million.
It's dropped to $25 million. The small biodiesel plants, that biodiesel production facilities, typically are $5 million or less to produce. So there would be a gap there where they would not qualify. And part of what we're trying to encourage is in some ways kind of a homegrown industry where
Farmers could produce their own biodiesel facilities, produce their own diesel, in essence. So I would want to try to find a way to still encourage the smaller facilities that would be under the $25 million cap. And not every area has the opportunity for an enterprise zone. And again, I'm happy to address that issue. Some areas clearly will never have enterprise zones, but may be appropriate for encouraging a biofuels production or a biooils production facility.
Let me stop and ask a question. Sure. There, and it's a dangerous question maybe, but when you talk about homegrown, how big are some of these plants? And I guess under current law, would these conceivably qualify as agricultural operations that could be placed on farmland?
Well, actually, that is a good question, Mr. Chair.
Farmers coming together and putting one of these things together to process their grain. Come on, we have a hand in the back.
Come up here. Thomas and the guy from Winter Biofuels again. Our company looked at producing what's considered a small-scale production facility. Really, the economically feasible size is 12 to 15 million gallons. So this is not something that's farm scale. But
what's the footprint of it? I don't know how big that is.
Less than 10 acres.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's including some fairly large tank storage pieces of equipment. So you're talking about less than 10 acres. Similar. How big is the ethanol facility that you're looking at?
43 acres.
We're looking at, and that's for 100 million gallons.
Yeah,
we're talking
right.
15 million gallons on less than 10 acres. So, mm-hmm. But it's not something, and the cost would be, our estimates, and they were rough estimates, for a 15 million gallon per year facility would be around $8 million, so far below that $25 million.
Okay.
But if you look at, for example, the Minnesota model where they built many 15 million gallon per year facilities, those are farmer-owned co-op facilities, mm-hmm. so they're small enough where the farmers can benefit from those. They're not these tremendously large commercial
industrial
facilities.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we'd be talking about. So having some incentive below $25 million would be very, very...
Mr. Chair, I assume you were raising a land use question.
Well, I was. Land use and also then whether or not these facilities can be built on farm deferred.
Yes. I think that's an excellent question. I am not schooled in that, but we can get the answer to you very quickly.
Good question, because that would be an incentive too.
As a matter of fact, it reminds me of the issue we had a couple sessions ago about wine.
Mm-hmm. Right, absolutely. Right.
Ancillary operations on their property.
Right.
So... it's worth looking into. I'm glad you raised it.
We're good at asking questions. Okay. Representative Kripp, you wanted to finish some comments. Yeah, you bet.
Again, Mr. Chair, the Columbia County circumstance that these gentlemen are talking about is very real, will require a substantial infrastructure investment. But not every potential facility in the state will require an infrastructure investment of that magnitude, or perhaps of hardly any magnitude in terms of a county or a city level, depending. And, as you know, there's great variables there. If we can put together an additional incentive that fills in those gaps I talked about earlier, that maybe strategic investment, maybe urban renewal, maybe enterprise zone doesn't fit, then that's what I think where we ought to go with this. And if we can get any net gain there for any county or city, I think it's a positive. But the other positive is that if you encourage this industry through these incentives and you put these production facilities in various places throughout the state, then the net gain is also positive in other ways in terms of property taxes in the local communities, because you have vibrant communities, there will be homes being built, there will be ancillary businesses that will come into effect there, or in some places in eastern Oregon where we're actually losing population in cities, you can perhaps reverse that trend. So there are other opportunities that come into play here, and I'm very happy to work with these gentlemen to reach some accommodations and move this concept forward. I think the opportunity is now for us to lay this foundation, Mr. Chair.
Very good. I appreciate the overview today, and I think it'd be worthwhile taking a look at that Columbia County question, since that obviously is something we'll need to deal with. But good stuff. Any other questions, comments before we close? All right. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Good hearing. Public hearing on House Bill 3551. And with that committee, we are adjourned for the day.